It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. For our next guest, the COVID-19 pandemic marked a turning point for the field of public health. On one hand, he says there's a lot to be thankful for in the public health world and that experts and officials accomplished a lot, often with limited resources. But on the other hand, he says the crisis exposed and increased some flaws in the world of public health. Among other things, he says public health experts lost the trust of many Americans, in part by letting the field become politicized and by rejecting viewpoints that didn't go along with the mainstream consensus. He says we're now in a place where the country's public health institutions and leaders need to take action to rebuild a lot of the trust with the public. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did public health experts, leaders, officials get right and wrong, do you think, during the pandemic? What do you think with hindsight now about things like partial shutdowns, mask mandates, remote schooling that we went through here in Wisconsin? Did it go on too long? Not long enough. Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sandro Galea is dean and Robert A. Knox professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. His new book is called Within Reason, A Liberal Public Health for an Illiberal Time. Sandro, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
I think to avoid confusion out here, I want to talk about the word liberal. And when we're talking about American politics, we use it as, you know, to the left, opposite of conservative, things like that. You're using it in a different sense and an older sense of the word. Talk about the meaning of liberal, especially in the public health context.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, exactly as you said, an older sense of the word liberal. By liberal, I mean Enlightenment era values, things that emerged from the Renaissance, really, which is a centering individual autonomy, centering the individual at the heart of decisions we make, making decisions based on reason, not theological concerns, and thinking about reasoned reform and building change slowly, keeping the individual at the heart of everything we do. In many respects, the notion of liberalism has more in common with and has echoes to today things like libertarianism, but it is fundamentally about saying an individual is autonomous and our role in society is to make sure that individuals live the best possible lives. That's what I mean by liberalism.
And one concern of many you raise in the book that you hope public health experts think about is you see a lack of concern about trade-offs on things like civil liberties when it comes to public health measures. I'm oversimplifying maybe, but to expand on that.
Yeah, no, I don't think you're oversimplifying. It's obviously a very complicated issue. But one of the challenges which I raise in the book, and by the way, I commend you on your introduction to the book because I think you summarize it very well, is that the lens of public health became very narrow, that we were focused only on one outcome and one outcome alone, which was to reduce the spread of COVID. Now, I'm careful in the book, and you also preface an introduction, to say this was a global pandemic, a global tragedy like none we have lived in 100 years. So there were reasons for us to be afraid. There were reasons for us to be cautious. But that fear led us to think only about one thing, which is COVID counts and consequences of COVID. And we forgot that societal decisions need to balance health, but also social function, educational function. All of that also, by the way, has implications for health in the long term. But it is a mistake to think that mitigating a virus today is the only thing that matters, because many other things matter in order for us to preserve, to go back to the notion of liberalism, individual autonomy, to create lives that individuals want to live in, find joy in, be able to actualize themselves, be able to have economic function, go to school and learn. All of those things are forces that we need to balance, and balance in the context of trade-offs as we think about right decisions for society. And public health pushed very hard and advocated very hard for a very narrow conception of that, one that focused only on the health dimension, forgetting these other dimensions that also should matter to us.
Where do you see the most damage from what you see as that lack of balance?
Well, I think in a number of ways. Pragmatically, for example, and you mentioned this also in your introduction, most experts now agree that kids have lost about 6 months of education. And by education, I mean both subject matter education, but also social and emotional development. That is an enormous consequence for society, because kids will carry that with them throughout their lives. Any of your listeners who have kids who were in school at the time, leaving aside the inconvenience and the difficulty of dealing with kids who are at school, you'd now recognize that there are behaviors that for their age, they're behind in because they had not had a chance to be socialized. So I think and perhaps on a smaller scale, there are these immediate consequences. Here I'm talking about kids. Obviously, it's a really important scale, but I call it smaller scale. Because at the larger scale, I think the consequence is a instinctive loss of trust in public health that people are showing. Now, I'm not just saying this impressionistically. Data, for example, from the Pew Trust Survey, which comes out about once a year, just came out about a month ago, shows there was about a 25-point drop in confidence in science and in health. That means that now it is a minority of people who trust that science and health are acting in the best interest of the public. And that is an enormous price to pay, because we want the public to trust that science and health is acting in the best interests of creating the kind of life we want. So I circle back in the book to saying that this loss of trust is a really profound consequence, that the downstream consequences years after COVID, if we cannot rectify this loss of trust, will be greater than the gains we made in a time of COVID by focusing so narrowly on the particular health outcome we were interested in.
Now, some might make the argument and have made the argument with, say, school closures. Kids aren't the only ones in schools. Staff might have been put at risk. We might have lost the teachers who are teaching those kids, disrupting education in a different way. People might weigh the balance you just presented in different ways, I guess.
Absolutely. And in fact, part of the book's core argument is that I want to encourage us weighing those arguments. I want to encourage people in good faith to have the arguments that balance what's the risk of transmission in schools. We knew all along that the risk of transmission for children is actually quite low, that the consequences for children were low. As a result, the risk of transmission to teachers was quite low. But was it low enough for us to keep schools closed? Maybe, maybe not. And in many ways in the book, I'm careful to illustrate these challenges without being dispositive about what the right thing for us to do was. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to say that in future, and the book is careful to be forward-looking, not backward-looking. Mm-hmm. I really don't come down one way or another on what we should have done on schools. And I do that intentionally because my goal is not to point fingers. This was a difficult time. A lot of good people tried to do the best possible under very difficult circumstances. What I'm trying to do is to say, if and when this happens again, we should create the space for that conversation, honestly articulating the benefits and the harms, the pros and the cons, so that we can come to the best place, best solution for society, weighing those harms and benefits.
Talking to Sandro Galea from the Boston University School of Public Health. His new book is called Within Reason, A Liberal Public Health for an Illiberal Time. You can join in with your thoughts on what you've heard from the guests, your questions for him at 800-642-1234. Maybe public health lessons you hope we learn from the COVID era. Join in at 800-642-1234. Another concern you raise, Sandro, is that the public health world became identified and partly of its own doing with one side of our political divide in the country. I wanted to get your thoughts on what you see driving that and the consequences.
Yes, we need to recognize that public health is always political. When something that public health is interested in and has to engage with changing social structures, that is political. However, being political means engaging in the public conversation about decisions we make as a society. It does not mean being identified with one party. Being political is different than being partisan. And one of the challenges public health faced during COVID was that it became a blue endeavor, where public health became identified with one particular party. Now, in the defense of public health, and I'm clear about this in the book, there was a president in the White House in 2020 who very explicitly was pushing back against a lot of well-established data, a lot of well-established fact about COVID. So public health found itself almost against its will in opposition. But be that as it may, the point I try to make is that the point of public health is to serve the health of the public, all the public. And that means that if public health is seen as serving only blue America, we are not doing our job. We're in fact doing only half our job. And it is on us to make the extra effort to make sure that everybody recognizes that public health is not blue or red, public health is purple.
And I know I've read elsewhere you've hosted dinners with people from conservative think tanks who are skeptical about the concept of public health as a government responsibility. How do you try to reach out across that boundary to get them on board and just to make your case to them?
In exactly that way, I would like to encourage conversations. We invite to our school speakers who come from different sides of the political spectrum with intentionality. We try to open up our community and encourage our community to have an open mind to arguments and debates from multiple sides of the political spectrum. That does not mean that one cannot arrive at a place in one's mind that balances empiric evidence and moral imperatives and say this is the right path forward. But it does mean that we should always have space to listen to a plurality of perspectives for people who have different value sets, who see the world differently, who bring a different moral perspective to the questions that matter to public health.
We're talking about how to improve public health, learn lessons from the COVID era, and issues of public trust for our public health system. Sandro Galea stays with us, Dean and Robert A. Knox Professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. His new book is called Within Reason, A Liberal Public Health for an Illiberal Time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Do you have lessons that you hope we learn from the COVID era and how we tackle issues of public health, how we balance concerns about stopping the spread of a virus with impositions, serious ones potentially, on our daily lives? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Sandro Galea, Dean and Professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. His new book is called Within Reason, A Liberal Public Health for an Illiberal Time. He's hoping we can learn lessons, do better with public health, rebuild public trust in the system, and have the system deserve that trust. At 800-642-1234, you could join in. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Let's bring on a caller now. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Hi, Chris.
Hello, good afternoon. So I guess my comment kind of slash question, if you will, I believe that I by and large agree with the guest, but I was wondering what your thoughts were on kind of the systematic approach to healthcare in this country, where our privatized approach seems to kind of incentivize a more profit-driven or politicized approach to healthcare. And only in more recent days here, post-pandemic, if you will, it seems that doctors have tried to kind of wrestle back some of that authority in kind of in more of a doctor-minded approach to medicine rather than a privatized one.
Chris, thanks for the call. Sandra, I think you were thinking about these issues long before we heard of COVID-19. Do you have some thoughts for Chris?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. The challenge that this country has is that we don't really have a healthcare system, right? What we have is a deeply fragmented system of multiple providers, many of them private providers. Even if it's a not-for-profit, they're still private providers that do what best serves their needs. And that does not create a system which incentivizes our values. And our values really are we want to be healthy, right? Chris wants to be healthy. I want to be healthy. Rob, you want to be healthy.
Sure.
So there is a tension between what we want out of healthcare and our healthcare system and how we structure it. That is a real problem. Now, in the context of COVID, we saw, for example, that our outcomes, when people were admitted to hospital with COVID in this country, they did as well as they did in any other country. So within hospitals, our care level tends to be very high. But what we are terrible at is marshaling a system to keep us healthy to begin with. That is a real problem. To do that, we are going to need an alignment of our national values with creating the kind of world that generates health. That means a world where we all have opportunities to exercise, where we have clean water, where we have clean air, where we have ability to live in a way where we work without overworking. All of that is what ultimately generates health. And those are the conditions that were not there before COVID, making us sicker than we needed to be before COVID hit, so that when COVID happened, we were then sitting ducks for getting even sicker.
Chris. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Sandro, another concern you raise in the book is that the public health community, I'll call it broadly, was subject to a kind of groupthink where people kind of wanted to line up with what they all agreed with and was not as open as you hoped to people offering differing opinions, raising concerns. How did you see that evolving?
Yeah, I observed, and I think many others have observed and written about this rapidity towards orthodoxy. And that orthodoxy was, I think we felt we had to do it because of the time pressure. But in doing so, we shut off room for discussion and debate, which has eventually come back to haunt us. I opened the book with this illustration, Rob, where I talk about a bakery where I get pastries every weekend. And in the end of 2021, this is after vaccines, when everybody was vaccinated, when mask mandates were lifted, the bakery had a sign on its door which said, "We know that in this community, health authorities have said we don't need to wear masks, but we feel otherwise, we still want you to wear a mask." Now, the reason I use that example is I ask the reader, can you imagine a time before COVID when a bakery, which doesn't have its own body of medical advisors, would put up a sign on the door that says, "Medical experts say the following, but we disagree, you should do something different." Like, it's hard to imagine that ever happening before COVID, right? That, to me, speaks to the things that we did in a way we did them eroded public trust. And I argue that us coming to conclusions in a particular way without listening to dissenting voices was part of what contributed to this problem.
Talking to Sandro Galea about his new book, Within Reason, A Liberal Public Health for an Illiberal Time. Sandro, over the course of the last few years, I've talked to a lot of public health experts, mostly here in Wisconsin, and they faced a challenge. We were learning on the job, kind of, with COVID as we figured out what it was doing, how it spread, things like that. They had a public that wanted definitive messages in some ways, but also they knew that the best answer they gave this week might be different next week. What lessons do you draw from that when it comes to health communication the next time there's an uncertain public health crisis?
My central lesson about health communication, and I think health communication is one of the areas where we probably have most to learn, is that we need to communicate uncertainty and be honest about it. One of the ways in which we faltered is, and in part this was because of social media and the way social media works and how one communicates on social media, is that we made pronouncements that felt definitive. We had what I call false certitude. And then when the data changed and we had to change our mind as was appropriate, it felt to the public like, well, we don't know what we're talking about and we were just wrong time and time again. One of the ways in which we need to get much better at communicating is to say, this is what we think is best today based on the data we have available. But let's be clear, when the data change and we expect them to change tomorrow or the day after, we are going to recommend something different and to be very clear in our communication that way. And my contention in the book is that people, the public, we can handle uncertainty. We can handle experts saying we don't know for certain that this is the answer, but this is what we think is best. And we faltered in trusting that people could handle uncertainty, feeling that we had to tell people, here are the facts, so that then when the facts changed, people rightly lost confidence in what we were saying.
One of your biggest worries, I think, if I'm reading you right, Sandro, is that we may face the temptation in this country, and public health leaders may face the temptation to give up on some of that liberal, old school version of liberal tradition and revert to something more authoritarian. The extreme example being China and its zero COVID policy, which I think most people in the United States think went way too far. How big a concern is that for you?
Well, I suppose when I have a conversation like this, Rob, I feel optimistic because I think the way to avoid that concern, the way to ward us away from that path is by having these conversations, by being honest about it, by saying, let us look forward. How can we do better? Let's create space for differing voices. As long as we can do that, I'm not so concerned. If we don't do that, then I am really worried. Yes, I do use the example of China, which I would argue was an effort that was not grounded in any science ever, and fundamentally a very authoritarian, deeply paternalistic approach that served more to advance political purposes in China than it did to advance public health, but it was done in the name of public health. And I call it chapter, not in the name of public health, specifically because of that. And I don't want public health, which is what I've given my adult professional life to make that mistake. I want us to make sure that we always are centering the individual, autonomy of the individual. We are driven by data, not by ideology, that we have the space to have multiple competing inputs so we can figure out the best possible path, recognizing that there may be more than one excellent path, and that we build a healthier world based on those foundations. And that is what the book tries to push for, and that is what conversations like this give me confidence that we can do.
I wonder, you know, when you read back about the influenza epidemic 100 years ago, or smallpox before we were even a country, these debates about public health measures versus our civil liberties, they've always been around. Is this something that public health is always going to be wrestling with?
I hope so, because I think there is no clear answer to any of these. And I think that's okay. I think the mistake is when we pretend there's a clear answer. The mistake is when we draw lines too quickly and where we say, no, the right answer is unequivocally the following, and without leaving space both for recognizing that your right answer and my right answer may feel different, and we should actually give space for that conversation. And B, the data may change tomorrow, and the right answer may change tomorrow.
Sandro, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Sandro Galea, Dean and Robert A. Knox Professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. He joined us for a look at his new book called Within Reason, A Liberal Public Health for an Illiberal Time. You can follow these conversations all the time, anytime at WPR.org, or you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio app for live streaming of all of our networks and extensive archives. Plus, if you like a conversation you hear, it's pretty easy to share it with a friend via social media, email, or what have you. Again, check it all out at WPR.org or with the Wisconsin Public Radio app. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. There's been a lot of attention over the last few years to the risks of repeated head injuries for athletes in contact sports. One big worry is chronic traumatic encephalopathy, called CTE for short. It's a potentially fatal degenerative brain disease found in people who experience repeated head trauma. As research on the disease has developed, it's become a major concern for professional-level contact sport athletes, including former Badger linebacker and briefly NFL player Chris Borland. Here he is in a PSA for the Union of Concerned Scientists.
My name is Chris Borland. I walked away from pro football and a $2.9 million contract with the San Francisco 49ers because I didn't want to develop CTE, or chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is caused by repeated brain injury. Researchers at Boston University studied the brains of 111 deceased NFL players. They found CTE in 110. CTE is a brain disease that causes depression, aggression, dementia, and in some cases, suicide. Yet for many years, the NFL denied the link.
A more recent study from Boston University published last fall found that even athletes at the youth level could be at risk of CTE. Our next guest is a Wisconsin expert on brain injuries in youth sports. She joins us now to weigh the risks of head injury with the benefits of youth sport participation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have kids who play contact sports like football? How early did they start? Have you taken any extra precautions to prevent head injuries and brain damage? Have you pulled your kids out of contact sports over those concerns? Did you grow up playing one of these sports? Do you look back and worry about what could have been? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Julie Stamm is a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Kinesiology at UW-Madison. She's the author of the book, The Brain on Youth Sports, The Science, The Myths, and The Future. Julie, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
First of all, Julie, can you give us a brief reminder of what CTE is, its causes, and what it does to people?
Yeah, CTE is a neurodegenerative disease, kind of similar to Alzheimer's disease or other neurodegenerative diseases you might have heard of. This disease in particular affects people who have been exposed to repetitive brain trauma. This is not just concussions. Concussions can be part of that trauma, but it's been diagnosed in people who have not had a history of concussions, at least diagnosed concussions. So it's just that repetitive brain trauma happening over and over and over again for years that we know is a risk factor for this disease. And it is affecting many parts of the brain, and as a result can have many symptoms, including, as you heard in the clip, aggression, impulsivity, difficulty controlling behaviors, memory difficulties and depression, mood difficulties as well. So it's a variety of different symptoms associated with it.
One difficulty in understanding the scope of the disease is, and correct me if I'm wrong, Julie, the only diagnosis is in an autopsy, unfortunately. We don't really have a system for diagnosing this in somebody who's still alive.
That's correct. Right now, we can only diagnose the disease after someone has passed away. And that's a huge limitation, not only for the patients, but also for research and furthering our understanding of the disease. We can't see it during life, in part because it doesn't look much different on a traditional MRI than Alzheimer's disease, for example. It looks very similar. There's a lot of research going into that, but we really need to figure out how to diagnose it during life.
One thing that makes complicated is to know how widespread it is. We hear the statistics from the Boston University studies, X percent of brains of these deceased athletes. You pointed out elsewhere, this is a skewed sample in some ways. We shouldn't necessarily panic and say, 40% or 100% or whatever of athletes will have CTE. Do I have that right?
Yes, absolutely. And that's a really important point. The studies that they're doing are trying to describe what the disease looks like in people who have it. And as part of that research, you report the number of people that you looked at that have the disease and those who don't. But it's a very biased sample. People don't tend to think to donate their brains to a brain bank like that unless they think that something's wrong. So you're more likely to find the disease in a brain bank sample like that. So the 110 out of 111 NFL players, for example, that does not mean that 99% of NFL players have the disease. It's just what they found in their sample. We really don't know how prevalent it is at this time because we can't diagnose it during life.
Now, another concern here is, NFL players, maybe they've played since they were 10 or younger, through high school, through college, through an NFL career. Boston University researchers have also looked now at some younger athletes, again, people who had symptoms that might have pointed towards CTE, and found that, yes, in fact, younger people can show this abnormal brain development from CTE.
Yes, and this is such an important point because I think for a long time, CTE was thought to be a disease of professional athletes. You had to play for 20 years or 10 years in the NFL to get the disease. And we know that's not the case. The recent study looked only at individuals under age 30, and the vast majority of them, 70% or more, were amateur athletes. And many of those only played through high school. So this is telling us that for some people, they may be at risk, even if they don't go on to play years in the NFL or even go on to play college.
Talking to Julie Stamm from the Department of Kinesiology at UW-Madison, author of the book, The Brain on Youth Sports, The Science, The Myths, and the Future. We're looking at repetitive brain injury for athletes, the impact it can have over time, CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and other potential outcomes, and how we evaluate those risks in our decisions as athletes or parents of athletes. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Julie, people will react to this kind of news in different ways. Some might say, okay, my kid's never going to play this kind of sport. Some might say, whatever. Where do you come down in terms of advice on how we manage contact sports, given what we know and are still learning about the impact of brain injuries?
Well, as we said, we don't know how prevalent this disease is. And we do know that sports have a lot of benefits. every kid should have the opportunity to play sports. So we shouldn't be getting rid of sports. We can modify them to make these sports safer and eliminate and minimize repetitive brain trauma in sport. For the people in this study of younger athletes, younger individuals who had CTE, those who had CTE had more overall years of play, and that's been consistent across the research. More total impacts over time equals greater risk. So when we start playing young, not only are we potentially disrupting all of the brain development that's happening, but we're also accumulating more hits over time. So we can delay the start of those impacts until we're a bit older. My preference would be high school, but at least until middle school. Then we're minimizing or reducing the overall career impacts we have. And then minimizing as much as possible those impacts when we do get to the high school level. And if you're good enough to go on to the college level, most people are just going to play through high school. So they'll have 4 years in that case if they delay contact until high school. And then maybe we don't hit at all or hit very, very little in practice. There are many championship teams across the country who don't hit at all, some coached by NFL players as well. And if we do that, we're minimizing our total career impacts, which really decreases the risk for developing CTE.
Let's bring on a caller. Paul is with us in Summit. Paul, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Great show. I was a wrestling coach. I've had 6 concussions myself. I've been in the combative arts for 10 years and no longer in it. And also a public school teacher. And, you know, we want kids to get the benefits of athletic competition and to be able to, you know, all the benefits from that. But at what point do we have a serious conversation at the high school and actually the middle school and the elementary level where we're exposing these kids to sports that we know is going to have lasting negative impacts on their health? You know, at what point are we going to, as a society, say enough is enough? I hate to be the one that squelches their fun, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all the benefits. But thanks for the great show.
Oh, Paul, before you go, I want to ask about your sport of choice over the years, wrestling. I mean, when do you think kids should start? What would ballpark? Where would you draw the line?
I have 2 boys. One's in 8th grade. One's in 9th grade. And we let them play. One plays sports, and we've. My wife has said she's in healthcare. She said no contact sports, but obviously baseball and basketball still have contact. But I think that at the elementary level, we're having kids play, football at the elementary level. And I think that the brain isn't developed fully. I think that I've seen kids get concussions. I've had kids on my wrestling team get concussions. And so I would say that we're going to have to talk about, you know, the whole sports experience from elementary, middle to high school.
Paul, thanks a lot for that call. Paul gave us a lot to work with, Julie. Jump on whatever you want from what he had to share.
Yeah, I think there was a lot to work with there. As you said, I really agree that delaying that start of contact, and it's not just contact, it's the sports where you're repetitively hitting your head, right? So football gets a lot of attention. But ice hockey, soccer, rugby, wrestling as well. I think there are ways to play these sports without the repetitive brain trauma. Flag football, hockey has eliminated checking before age 13 and before age 15 in some leagues as well. And they've had great success with that. Heading is limited in soccer for young individuals. You can play flag rugby too. So playing versions of these sports where we're not hitting our head repeatedly. We will never prevent every concussion, but we can prevent those repetitive impacts that can lead to this disease, regardless of whether or not you have a concussion. And of course, we also need to treat these concussions appropriately, identify them, manage them, and make sure that we're being extra conservative with kids who, as our caller said, the brain is still developing. So we really want to protect that.
Thanks so much for that call. We're talking to Julie Stamm, clinical assistant professor in the Department of Kinesiology at UW-Madison, author of the book, The Brain on Youth Sports, The Science, The Myths, and The Future. We're talking about the most recent research on repeated brain injuries for young athletes, especially in contact sports, the risk of CTE and other conditions. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Has this been a story in your life? Have your loved one been in one of these sports and maybe felt some of these consequences or been worried about it? How are you managing these issues for your own family, your own team? If you're a coach, maybe at a school or a club, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Julie Stamm, clinical assistant professor in the Department of Kinesiology at UW-Madison, author of the book The Brain on Youth Sports, The Science, the Myths, and the Future. We're talking about the risks of repeated brain injuries and impacts in younger athletes in particular, recent research on how early we could see the effects of CTE, a degenerative brain disease. Still time for your calls, your thoughts, questions, or maybe your own experiences at 800-642-1234. Have concerns about brain damage impacted choices about what sports to participate in for you or your kids? Or in hindsight, do you wish they had? Are you with some sort of sports organization that is maybe changing the rules, changing age guidelines for certain behaviors, heading, tackling, and more? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Julie, we're focusing mostly on CTE, but you've pointed out in your book and elsewhere, that's not the only potential risk of repeated head impacts. What other concerns are out there?
That's true. With kids, the brain is rapidly developing, and there is research that I've done and my colleagues have done that suggests that we may be disrupting some of those processes while we hit our head repeatedly as kids. So that's one thing that's very important, is we really want to have our kids have the best possible brain development they can have and gain all of the skills and make all the connections in the brain that they can when they're young. So that's something that we want to protect as well. We also know that some of the symptoms of CTE can also happen even when CTE is not there. So things like depression and other psychiatric disorders, for example, have been increasingly linked recently to repetitive brain trauma and to concussions, and that's separate from the disease. So that's another concern that we have, that even in this study that we've been talking about, almost everyone had symptoms, but not everyone had CTE. On the good side, these symptoms can be treated. So even if you're experiencing depression, for example, and you played high school football, it does not mean you have CTE. Odds are you probably don't. But that's a symptom that can be treated. And it could be linked to the brain trauma. But again, it can be treated. So that's another concern that's growing in the research community regarding brain trauma in sport.
Right. I wanted to bring that up. Treatment, again, we don't know if any particular person has CTE, but is there enough awareness among athletes of and their parents of signs of depression or other behavioral changes where they should maybe sit up and take notice, reach out and see what kind of help is available?
Definitely reach out and seek help, because it's very likely that it's not CTE, especially if you've played only through high school. I think we have to be aware that it could be. It's possible that it could be, because the research shows us that it could be. But it seems more likely that that risk is relatively low, especially if you have only played only through high school. We know it's not zero, though. But regardless, if you are having these symptoms, do reach out to a healthcare provider. There are treatments for depression and anxiety and apathy and many of these symptoms. And again, it may not be related to CTE. And if it is, we can't treat CTE at this time because we don't know how to even diagnose it. But we can treat these symptoms.
Let's bring on another caller now. Bill is with us in Arcadia. Bill, hi.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to comment that wrestling has changed some of the rules to protect from concussion.
What kind of changes have you seen, Bill?
Well, there's something called the two-on-one, that where if you're grasping the other person standing up, see if I can describe this so you can understand. But if we're both standing up and I'm behind you and I grab your bicep basically and your wrist, and the typical finish to that was to take you to the side where the elbow was controlled so you didn't have that ability to catch yourself.
Ah.
And that is now illegal.
Because I probably hit my head in that instance.
Exactly. Exactly.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call. Now, Julie, I imagine you talk to people in the sports world a lot. And I don't know, I feel like in the old days, whenever that was, there'd be a lot of resistance to rules changes like no checking in hockey or outlawing certain maneuvers in wrestling and things like that. Are you seeing the youth sports world open up to these changes more?
Yes, we definitely are, which is great. Different leagues and different sports have had more or fewer changes that have been made. It's great to hear about that change in wrestling to protect the head. The change with delaying the start of checking has been very successful. Not only have they seen a reduction in concussions, but also in overall injuries in hockey as a result of that rule. There's less research that's gone into soccer so far. Football's been somewhat mixed, so reducing practice time related to contact has been helpful in some cases. It has, in general, decreased the number of concussions and impacts that occur in practice, although games are still the same, but that is still overall reduction since we spend more time in practice, especially. But it is really coach-specific as well, and I think that's an important point. Take-home point for any coaches or parents listening too, that the culture is very, very important. Some studies have shown that even if the amount of time dedicated to contact has been reduced, some coaches just try to fit all of that contact into such a short amount of time that they actually end up hitting more in practice and have more injuries. So it's really taking that health of your athlete, whether that's your child or whether that's your athletes if you're a coach, really taking that health to heart and prioritizing that and minimizing impacts using drills and other techniques and practice time to get the skills across without the impacts.
Bill, thanks a lot for sharing that rule change. Julie, I know you've mentioned CTE. It isn't a story just about concussions. It can be what I think are called subconcussive impacts. That said, I feel like I'm seeing a lot more attention to concussions themselves at the highest levels of the sports world. Are we seeing better treatment, better handling when that athlete does, that young athlete does have what appears to be a concussion?
I think we are. I think we've made big strides in the last decade plus. There have been a lot of changes in the last decade. For example, we used to say, lock yourself in a dark room if you have a concussion. And now we know that exercise can actually be helpful. The initial recommendation was based on logic, right? If your symptoms become worse when you exercise your brain or exercise your body, don't do it. But now we know that it's okay if they get a little bit worse, but the exercise is within limits. Limited exercise is helpful for your brain and healing. So that's just one change that we have done that has really improved outcomes. And I think we're doing a better job of recognizing concussions. It's still really difficult. You know, we still see cases in the NFL that go undiagnosed, at least initially. And they have so many medical providers and spotters in the booth. And at a youth football game, you might just have a coach. So it's still difficult. And athletes have to tell us about their symptoms oftentimes. So we still have a long ways to go, but there have been good strides that have been made.
Juliet, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Julie Stamm, clinical assistant professor in the Department of Kinesiology at UW-Madison, author of the book, The Brain on Youth Sports, The Science, The Myths, and The Future. She joins to talk about CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, that's a chronic brain injury, and what recent research says about the risks facing young athletes in contact sports, and how to weigh those risks as athletes, as parents, as coaches. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this or share your story or maybe a rule change you've seen in whatever sport you or your youth are involved in. You could do that a couple ways. You could email ideas@WPR.org or you can post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, Wisconsin's voting maps need to change after a ruling from the state Supreme Court. What is that going to mean? A Wisconsin researcher tells us what it takes to make a new map and what could change in the world of state politics. As always, you can weigh in with your thoughts, your hopes for the outcome, and your questions for the morning show guest. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, we invited you to call in and share your favorite hobbies. A lot of you called in during the show. We heard from some more of you on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here's a couple. Stacy writes, I wish pigeon racing would make a comeback. Unfortunately, most of the people in the hobby are elderly and passing on. Stacy says, pigeons are wonderful little characters who can be pretty friendly if you spend the time with them. And Nick tells us, my favorite hobby is painting miniatures for display and for tabletop games like D&D. And Nick shared some pictures of his handiwork with us. Speaking of pictures, Dick from Darlington had called in yesterday to tell us about his hobby of collecting rolls of duct tape from around the country, around the world, and beyond, including duct tape from the International Space Station. After the show, he sent us some pictures of that collection, how it's organized, the orbital duct tape, and a roll from Antarctica. He's gotten duct tape, he says, from 92 countries. He's got a list of the rest that he still wants tape from. Still time to share your hobby. Email ideas@wpr.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time.